Hello, I'm Adrian Dobb.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
Whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So, Adrian, just a couple of weeks ago, we did an episode together on the death of Renee Good, the Minneapolis woman who was shot three times by ICE agent Jonathan Ross. The sort of gender ideology that was revealed both in her murder itself and also in the right's reaction to her death and the viral video of her killing. And we're coming back to your feed today to discuss yet another murder in Minneapolis and its aftermath. So today we're going to be talking about the killing of Alex Priddy, another white Minneapolis resident, another 37-year-old, and another person who confronted ICE officers' kidnapping, harassment, and occupation operations in his home city with a kind of principled opposition and who paid for that principle with his life.
Yeah, as long as ICE keeps murdering people, we'll keep making these episodes. And right now, as of a few days ago, ICE is responsible for fully two-thirds of the homicides in the Minneapolis area. Let that sink in. A government agency is, in fact, responsible for most of the crime in the city.
Adrian, I think maybe we should just set the scene a little. What happened to Alex Priddy?
So Alex Priddy was a 37-year-old nurse at the VA, at the Veterans Affairs Hospital, and was an active participant in ICE Watch and had apparently had interactions with the feds before, which will, I'm sure, come up in the right's reaction to it. What happened was that someone else got thrown to the ground by ICE. Alex Priddy decided to try and help her up. He was then either thrown to the ground or already shot. A gun of some sort was taken from him. And after that, I forget the number of shots.
10 shots in 5 seconds.
Right.
Yeah, he was being pepper sprayed. He had a phone in one hand and had raised his other hand to sort of shield his face from the pepper spray. And then he was tackled to the ground. And then his gun was removed from him. And then the officers opened fire, and he was shot 10 times, including several rounds shot into him when he was already laying motionless. You know, when they started shooting, he had been sort of struggling a little to try and get up and free himself, although he was on the ground. And then by the time they stopped shooting, he was already dead.
Most of our American listeners will know this, but just to reemphasize, Minnesota is a concealed carry state, meaning he had every right to be there with a weapon. He was properly licensed to own it and to keep it on his person. You and I may not agree with that, right? But he was exercising it. And this is something that the right has claimed is, in fact, part of its style of masculinity. And it's why I think we're already getting into very interesting gender territory in that, like, people showing up with guns is something the right professes to love. And this man did so in the most responsible way possible, and he paid with his life for it anyway.
Yeah, you know, I think the facts of the matter here are crucial because of the administration's sort of miscasting of them in the hours and days after Priddy's death. But when Priddy was killed, his gun was not in his possession.
That's right.
He never reached for his firearm. He never had his firearm in his hand. It was removed from him before the first shots were fired. So he posed no threat to the ICE officers who murdered him at the time of his death.
Yeah. And just by point of contrast, older listeners will remember the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, who went to a Black Lives Matter protest and murdered two protesters. No one shot him. So, yeah, the historical parallels suggest that it does matter an awful lot in this country who bears arms and to what purpose.
Right. I think your point about the masculine fantasy of gun ownership that animates organizations like the NRA, right? This notion of either a well-organized militia resisting government tyranny or a good guy with a gun using a capacity for violence for righteous ends. Both of these could be evoked in Alex Priddy's actions, but they were not, right? Those actors very much lined up behind the ICE agents and behind the use of force in this case. So I think one thing that might be interesting as we talk about the gendered response to Alex Priddy's death and the political fallout, which has been, you know, interesting and sort of and mixed, is talking about gender in the anti-ICE resistance as we're seeing it emerge in Minneapolis. because these videos that have come out of street confrontations with ICE agents, of, you know, these forceful in-person, face-to-face encounters in which Minneapolis residents are confronting the armed, masked agents of the sort of like deportation regime in the streets, in public, with a high capacity for violence, with direct confrontation, and trying to like physically impede or obstruct or slow down their operations. Those are getting a lot of play, right? They're what's featured in the snuff videos of Alex Preti and Renee Good's deaths, but they're also what's featured in these kind of viral moments of like a very visible anti-ICE sentiment in Minnesota. And I think that's interesting because it's just one part of what seems to me to be a much broader effort of anti-ICE and sort of like pro-immigrant mutual aid and support. You see these pretty vast networks that are tackling ICE's presence and its implications for Minneapolis from a lot of different angles. So one thing you have is the ICE Watch and ICE Patrol, in which these signal groups with a whole lot of people on them are springing up to share information about where ICE has been seen, what vehicles they're driving, where they're going. And then you get people sort of following behind in their cars, right? Blowing whistles to warn people to go inside and trying to film these kidnappings and get the detained immigrants to like shout out their names so that their family can be alerted that they've been taken.
Yeah.
You also see a large scale organization of like material support to those who are targeted and those who are in hiding. So one thing about ICE's presence in Minneapolis, and we know this has also happened elsewhere, is that the threat of being kidnapped means that a lot of people are not really leaving their homes. Immigrants, people who are documented and undocumented, and sometimes people who are just, you know, people of color, are tending to stay in their homes so that even if, you know, they're not sent to a concentration camp and eventually deported, they also don't risk being just sort of like grabbed and beat up by ICE, which is also happening, or, you know, dumped in a forest on the outskirts of the city, which is also happening. These people are sort of reckoning that the public sphere has been made unsafe for them because of people who are targeting people like them on the basis of their race. So they've retreated to their homes, and that means a lot of stuff. It means they can't work in many cases. Rent is coming due, and a lot of them have lost substantial income. A lot of businesses also that had large immigrant customer bases are also losing a ton of income. Like, the economic hit has been really kind of severe in Minneapolis. It means that they need groceries, which they both can't afford to buy and also can't really safely go out and get. A lot of people are trying to keep their kids in school, but don't feel safe taking their kids to school. We have folks like Liam Ramos, the 5-year-old who was detained by ICE, and his father. They were simply coming home from school, and because they were outside their house, they were kidnapped in their driveway. So you have these networks that are doing things like pooling money for rent for immigrant neighbors. You have these networks that are doing things like escorting kids to school when their parents aren't safe to take them. You know, you have people who are picking up groceries and dropping off bags of groceries at the homes of people who are in hiding because of this massive ethnic cleansing effort going on in their city, right? So there's a lot of feminized work going on. There's sort of quiet care and maintenance and support work going on for immigrants that is harder to document. It's not as flashy. It's not getting as much media attention. It's not being documented online quite as much. And that tends to be feminized. And I don't just say that because of the kind of work it is, how much it looks like care work, how much it looks like housework. But I'm also saying because it's being done by women, right? This is something happening often through pre-existing networks of women whose kids go to the same school or the same daycare or whose kids are on, you know, like sports teams together. So a lot of like the sort of feminized, mom-focused childcare work that is being collectivized and shared among women everywhere just because of the sheer scale of it and the need for logistical coordination.
Yeah.
Those networks, that work is now being sort of collectivized as a means of, you know, like cross-racial solidarity and resistance to state terror. And that's kind of a feminized version. And that's different than what Alex Priddy was doing in the street, which is a more masculinized version. I want to be clear, like, Renee Good was fully a woman doing a fully in-person, aggressive, you know, like calm but direct confrontation with ICE agents when they shot her. And I have seen basically in every video, like a mixed gender group of people confronting ICE agents in public. That said, the actual effort takes on a more masculine sheen, right? It's a direct, potentially violent, physical confrontation with a bully. And that's something we tend to think of as sort of like a masculine mode.
Yeah.
Even though there's, you know, plenty of women doing it.
Yeah. So we'll have to talk about why this killing sort of landed differently from the killing of Renee Good. And I mean, some of it certainly is going to have to do just with repetition, with the fact that, you know, you had this so hot on the heels of the last murder. The other thing, though, is that in the metabolization, the gender politics of denialism sort of started cracking up in the sense that the right had just sort of settled on a gendered way to discount what had happened to Renee Good, and then a dude with a gun gets shot, right? So you're just like, okay, you've just written all these like insane white women takes, and suddenly it's like a guy who works at the VA and who's a legally licensed gun owner, right? Like they can come up with like gendered critiques or like avoidance mechanisms like in the moment, but they're happening in such rapid succession at this point that they kind of collapse under their own weight, or they can't sort of find a groove that people don't notice. Like, wait, didn't you argue the opposite like 48 hours ago? What happened there?
Yeah, you know, I think you're right that one feature of the sort of more intensified response from the public and from anti-Trump forces to Priddy's murder is cumulative. And I also think that it matters in the particulars of this incident that in the viral videos of this murder, of Priddy's murder, you can see his physical body. You can see him struggle, and then you can see him come to stillness. And that's very clear on camera. That's different from the images of Renee Good's killing, where you can see her car, but not her corpse. But it also strikes me, yeah, I think you're right, Adrian, that one reason why Priddy has received such sympathy and why his death has shifted the conversation so much more than Good's death did is that he was a, you know, he was a gender-conforming straight man, by all accounts.
Yeah.
He was engaged in what he clearly understood to be a feat of masculine heroism, an action that is legible as masculine heroism, right? It does matter.
Trying to help someone up, yeah.
Yeah, and as a man, he is thought of as more significant and less disposable than Renee Good was. That sort of script that the Trump administration reached for about an annoying, uppity woman who condescends to you and scolds to you, and don't you have this libidinal investment in being able to, like,
murder her.
Or, yeah, we're like, silence her claim to authority or significance in relation to you with violence, right? That is a typical masculine fantasy. That is harder with Alex Priddy because the kind of guys that they're trying to appeal with that message, like, are more likely to see themselves in Priddy than they were to see themselves in Good. Before we get too deep into it, Adrian, do you want to talk a little bit about what the reaction was after Priddy died?
So the first reaction was to lie about it yet again. And I think this is the other part of the repetition. Like with Renee Good, basically their story barely held up for like 2 hours. And like, this is the first time I can remember the New York Times even went out and was like, this is not covered by the facts. I'm like, wow, now you care, New York Times. That's so weird. But yeah, the same thing happened with Priddy. Like, you had Scott Bessent out there being like, well, you don't show up to a protest with guns. It's like, well, I guess you forgot to tell all your buddies on January 6th. But like, yeah, the idea was like, oh, you shouldn't protest with a gun, which like you absolutely can. Again, I don't think that's a great idea, but like we have the law we have in this country, but apparently it only applies to half the population. Then it was like, you know, he was going to kill people. He was basically treated like a school shooter. So Christy Noem implied that he was going to massacre law enforcement. Now, I think we can talk about massacre and law enforcement, but I think it's a massacre that is being done by law enforcement. This goes hand in hand with what Adam Serwer, I think, has called the small bean theory of fascism, where like ICE agents keep killing people with impunity. And at the same time, it's like, oh, did you know that threats against them up 13,000%? It's like, yeah, I bet. Being a literal Nazi will come with some threats, with some harsh words, gotta tell you. But yeah, so like this idea that like this guy was essentially a school shooter in waiting that had to be put down. And then the other reaction that you saw as more and more video was coming out was that this man had had a previous interaction with ICE where like, you know, something sacred like a taillight might have taken some damage. And so that obviously makes it okay to murder a man. Yeah.
Yeah. Like with Renee Good, they released a subsequent video, right? And this video was meant...
He was no angel, Moira. Did you know?
Yeah, this video was meant to like change public opinion about his character and his worthiness as a target for violence, right? And in the video that they released of Renee Good, she is speaking to a masked and armed ICE agent in a way where her politeness could possibly be interpreted as disingenuous, right? like, oh my gosh, do I detect a hint of sarcasm when Renee Good says, that's fine, dude, we're not mad at you.
Believe it or not, that's a death sentence in America now.
And with Alex Preddy, you know, he is filmed at a previous encounter with ICE agents in which he kicks a taillight and I think says something to the effect of like, fuck you. I think he says the F word at some point.
Also, now a capital offense, apparently.
I gotta say, both of these videos made me like these people more.
Oh, like, yeah. Wow, no, they're both based as hell, yeah.
These people are engaging in outward displays of contempt for tyranny. And Alex Pretty is like, I mean, both of them, but Alex Pretty, I think, like more self-consciously was like risking his physical safety to do so.
Yeah, yeah. I think we both went to the big protest here in San Francisco, and I went to the first sort of anti-ICE protest of the year, which was fairly small, and then I've been to a bunch more. Yesterday's was massive, 100,000 people in San Francisco alone. I think part of that is about the hyper-visibility of these videos, but I think there's also the invisible behind it. 8 people have died in ICE custody this year that we know of. And there are stories about all of them. And yet ICE has all these stories about Alex Pretty and Renee Good that we know to be utter horseshit. What stories are you telling us about these people? And I think people are really waking up to the fact that their government is lying to them about mass murder, very, very likely. And that what we're told about death in ICE custody, you know, why would we believe them there? Why would they suddenly be starting to tell the truth when they lie to our faces about stuff that other people recorded from like 8 different angles?
Yeah, they'll lie to you about something that's very, very obvious and evidenced abundantly by other sources. And, you know, I think this is also a good point, Adrian, that the reporting from what's going on inside these camps is pretty scattershot.
Yeah.
It's not getting the sort of like viral traction and public attention, but it's also not coming out as much because I think partly because ICE is now such an ideologically uniform entity, that there's just not a ton of people who are staffing these concentration camps who are like, this is fucked up, I'm going to leak about it. I think those people left already or purged already. And the people who are working for ICE and Border Patrol now are true believers who don't really have much of a problem with what's going on. But there are dribs and drabs, right? So a man was charged with sexual abuse for a quote-unquote sexual relationship in the term the media coverage I saw with a woman, a Nicaraguan woman, who was imprisoned in an ICE facility where he was working.
Do we have a word for a relationship with the person who's in prison and can't consent?
I call it rape. I think it's called fucking rape.
Gee, English is an impoverished language that we don't have a fucking word for that. Yes, we do. It's called rape.
And there's, you know, increasing reporting coming out about pregnant women in ICE detention who are miscarrying and being refused medical attention. We have reports of sour and putrid food being served to them, people who are not allowed to go to the bathroom, and so they're just like defecating and urinating on the floor. Like horrendous stuff, right? The nightmare that you can imagine seems to be what's happening. And one Cuban national who was detained, I believe, at a border facility in Texas, died. And his death was ruled a homicide. And it seems from the reporting that's now available that he was strangled to death by the guards. And, you know, I think one thing that's happening is that these very visible deaths of white people at the hands of ICE are being taken as an opportunity to kind of metabolize this sort of inchoate sense of terror in the back of a lot of people's minds about the violence that's being done that's not visible. The violence that's being done that's not being filmed by 100 cell phones, that's not being reported on as widely, that we can't quite see, but that many of us know on some level, and I think more and more conscious one, is happening. That what is happening in these camps is horrendous, and it's something that we're going to have to pay for and atone for, because we can't really say that we don't know what's going on, right? And that's part of what's going on when, you know, I was also at that protest yesterday in San Francisco, and I had the thought that I would find you, and then I got there and realized it was like 100,000 people in Dolores Park. Like, I was never going to find Adrian. And I think part of what is motivating people to start taking to the streets is the sense that they are implicated in something even worse than the death of Pretty and Good, something even larger.
Yeah. For those of us old enough to remember Abu Ghraib, we have a pretty good idea of what eventually will come down the pike, let's be honest. And those were U.S. soldiers, right? Like, they have a lot more training than these fucking gomers. So, like, yeah, what we're going to get is at least some version of that, if not worse. I'm calling it now. As a guy who's just lived a long time.
I think, like, if you've read Night, you might know some of what we're going to be talking about. Yeah. You know, if you got, as a lot of us did as good little, like, liberal American children, a Holocaust education, like, you know that the camps are not places you're going to be proud of, right?
Yeah.
So this might bring us to the function of whiteness, right? Which is kind of also kind of the elephant in the room when we talk about the Pretty and Good killings. Like, I don't think it takes anything away from the horror of Pretty and Good's deaths and the loss of their lives to say that their murders have galvanized white imaginations, not just because they serve this stand-in purpose, but because they are themselves white people, right? Audiences see Pretty and Good as, like, unusual and different targets of state violence, as people they are unaccustomed to seeing being declared disposable. I can say for my part, and I'm not really proud of this, it did matter to me that Renee Good was a married lesbian, like, almost exactly my age.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It means a lot to me, too, how familiar Alex Pretty seemed. Like, honestly, he reminded me of somebody my friend Brooke would meet on a dating site and, like, bring along to, like, a barbecue. Like, their whiteness, their relative youth, their markings of middle class status, all of these made these people, like, very familiar to me.
Yeah.
And I think that made their deaths, like, the video of their death, more psychically potent to a lot of white middle class audiences, right? This is not an endorsement of this reality. I think what I'm describing here is, like, racist and unfair. But it's also a real phenomenon shaping the responses to these deaths.
Yeah, I mean, like, with Good, the fact that she had just dropped off her child at school, right? Like, it's just like it grabs you and you're like, holy shit. Like, when I found out I had just dropped off my daughter at school, right? Like, it makes you realize that during Black Lives Matter, very frequently, the media would emphasize the things that those murdered by police had done that would remove them from recognizability, right? Mm. They had, you know, sold loose cigarettes. And the media would kind of lean on that in order, I think, to activate a withdrawal of empathy, to insist on difference. Well, do you really recognize yourself in this person?
Yeah. And I think that Pretty and Good's whiteness, it doesn't just galvanize this kind of, like, passively racist, like, readiness of sympathy on the part of national audiences. Is also clearly animating a specific kind of, like, resentment and anger from the MAGA white supremacist coalition. So we talked in our episode about Renee Good, about how responses to her killing emphasized her white womanhood as a marker of her, like, frivolity and worthiness for contempt. But that wasn't coming from, like, a 2018 woke person complaining about white women feminism, right? It was coming from the right.
Yeah.
And so Pretty's whiteness was also noted in the initial right-wing response to his death as evidence of, like, a scourge of supposed violence on the part of liberal whites. And something that's not getting a ton of play in the coverage of Minnesota, but which I have seen mentioned sporadically by people who are, like, reporting on the ground, is that the resistance in Minnesota, that, like, street-level resistance to ICE agents, is largely composed of white people out of the sheer reality that, as we said, people of color are in danger on the streets. And many of them have been pushed out of public life, right? It is dangerous for them to chase down ICE vehicles. And that means that the confrontational part of this resistance is composed largely of white people who are taking on a kind of like risk proportional to their privilege. And what's so infuriating about these like liberal white people confronting ICE, about the likes of Good and Pretty to MAGA, is not just the like sort of organization and passion of the Minnesota opposition, but also a sense of like racial betrayal.
Yeah. I mean, Nick Fuentes literally called Pretty a race traitor.
He literally called him a race traitor. It's like, yeah, he just said it. He just admits it. You know, I wrote this whole podcast script and then he just tweeted it out.
He tweeted it out.
But it's like the sense is like, oh, these are white people standing in solidarity with people of color against a white supremacist ethnic cleansing project. And that refusal of racial loyalty to whiteness is clearly seen as like an unfair refusal to play by the rules that the Trump camp is setting up, right? The sense of whiteness as like a community or a debt in the white supremacist imagination is coming in a clash in Minnesota against the reality of how whiteness actually functions in like real white people's American lives, in which case it might be ambivalent or disavowed or like kind of only partially invested in or not invested in that way. Like, I can't honestly vouch for the racial politics of every white person on the street in Minnesota, but they're not all imagining themselves clearly as having more in common with J.D. Vance because they're white than they do with their neighbors who are Somali, right? And that's, I think, a tension that the white supremacist MAGA right is like really angry about, that like whiteness doesn't have the kind of purchase in the imaginations and in the sentiments of all white people that it does for them.
That's again something that Adam Serwer, I think, pointed out in his very good reporting from Minneapolis, that like you can tell that the MAGA theory of power, which was routed through the category of whiteness, is sort of coming apart. Like, this is a confusion that Stephen Miller, that Jesse Waters, that Nick Fuentes, that Ben Shapiro, that J.D. Vance share with the ICE agents on the ground. Confusion is like, wait, you're supposed to be on my side. I'm hunting them for you. And now you're telling me that I'm a fucking asshole just on the technicality that I pulled a pregnant woman out of a car and beat her 5-year-old or whatever I just did, right? Like, for them, that is treason. You know, like, people always shouted at us when we were like, well, these are just white supremacists. It's like, oh, it's just like your favorite taunt for them right now. It's like, no, we mean it. And it's currently fucking them up real bad.
I think something that's going on in that sense of betrayal is not just that Minneapolis and Alex Pretty and Renee Good are like interrupting the MAGA sense of like white supremacist unity. I think they're also interrupting the fantasy of like ICE masculinity.
Yeah.
And so like one thing that I think is really potent for the like MAGA imagination of ICE and this like clearly they thought they were kind of going to be greeted as liberators, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a repeated sense in which like, oh, we're going to go sadistically punish the people who didn't vote for us, the people like we've, you know, been hating on the internet for 10 years. But they also saw there would be this like kind of groundswell of white support for an ethnic cleansing project that like now hasn't materialized.
Yeah.
But part of what they really kind of wanted to happen was to be the like, I don't know, like it reminds me of like a cheap knockoff ensemble action series, like one of the lesser Marvel movies where like a gang of like ragtag men who like don't play by the rules and say fuck a lot, they go and they set things right. You know, this is kind of like imagined masculine displays of virility and of power that remind me a lot of like, just candidly, like the Trump supporter who's closest to me, this guy in my family, who I love, even though he drives me nuts. Like, part of what he loves about Donald Trump is that Donald Trump reminds him of the mob bosses who operated in Brooklyn when he was growing up. And he's like, these guys, they got rid of the bullies. Like, they defended the neighborhood. They had a monopoly on violence, and that meant that we were protected, right?
Yeah.
You know, the gangster represented masculine heroism in the sense that he, like, discarded the rules and the law and politeness to do what needed to be done for his community and for his principle. And this was, like, a way in which this guy sort of, you know, he hates liars, he hates cowards, he hates people who take the easy way out. And he's drawn to Trump and to the ICE agents because he sees them as these like honest, virile, aggressive, bravely confrontational people who oppose this like effete establishment entrenched power and are like willing to like stand up to them, right? Alex Preddy's actual actions modeled exactly that guy's fantasy, right? Like he embodied this kind of masculinity. He like, one, confronted authority. Two, he didn't have anybody's like sanction or permission to do that except for his own. He was, three, out to defend his neighbors, and four, like willing to risk violence, right? That's a man enacting a very specifically male model of civic responsibility and heroism of the kind that has animated a lot of like psychic investment in Trump, in his like racist project and in his like male supremacist project. And there doesn't seem to be a recognition in the guy in my life with like the cognitive dissonance of that contradiction that like the guy whose side he's on is the guy who's actually like victimizing the kind of behavior that he idolizes. But I do think it sort of cracked something, because what you see now is that at least for a couple of days, it really seemed like the Trump administration was scared of the reaction to the Alex Preddy shooting. And they almost seemed for a little bit like they were looking for the exits. I think we could probably qualify that now, a few days later.
Yeah. The other thing I want to point out, and I think I'm stealing this from somewhere, and I can't remember where, it's possible like Greg Sargent said this, part of the self-understanding of white supremacists, the reason why they think of themselves as majoritarian, even though most white people in the United States will in fact say like, I don't want any part of this, is that they think, oh, these people are just virtue signaling, right? Political correctness, cancel culture, is keeping them from saying what they really mean, which is white supremacy. And that makes it really hard when someone puts their life on the line and is like, no, these are my neighbors. I'm going to stand up for them. Get the fuck out of my neighborhood, right? Like, leave them alone. And this kind of incoherent rage that's bubbling up amongst them is about the fact that, like, they genuinely thought they had a theory for this, which would have indicated that white people will just kind of cave, which when it came to, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs and Jeff Bezos of the world, when it came to university administrators, when it came to university presidents, when it came to news networks, when it came to Hollywood, a lot of this was virtue signaling and they didn't really mean it. Well, unfortunately for them, turns out the VA nurses of the world and the soccer moms of the greater Minneapolis-St. Paul area did mean it and do really consider their neighbors more important than Gestapo thugs parading down the street. And it's fucking them up.
Mm-hmm. So the Trump camp sort of seemed to sense a degree of danger in the public response to Alex Preddy's killing. And they tried to kind of like walk it back a little.
Yeah.
They fired Greg Bovino from his role as the head of Border Patrol.
I like how you can't say his name without giggling a little bit.
I know. I keep thinking of him as, I mix up Greg Bovino and Don Bongino.
Yes, that happened to me too.
They're different guys, both no longer in the Trump administration, I guess.
They're different names, but I think it might be the same guy.
But like Greg Bovino, do you want to tell us a little bit about him? He was very camera forward, very interested in being the face of the deportation agenda.
Yeah. So he's, you know, people always say ICE. He's not an ICE guy, I believe. He's U.S. Border Patrol.
Yep. Yeah.
And as you say, the camera face for Border Patrol, he was the tactical commander for the mass raids in L.A. last year. He comes out of El Centro, California. That's the sector he used to work at. And he is this tiny, teeny man who, you know, nothing against short kings, but like that man is the shortest short kings come. And he just seemed to love the spotlight in the way that like some of these Trump guys kind of do love to kind of play the heel for the cameras, right? Like if you remember Joe Arpaio, he had kind of Joe Arpaio energy, sort of like a little bit of Caudillo energy, a little bit of Rough Rider energy, and a whole bunch of weird masculinity politics. And he got shit canned.
You're burying the lead, Adrian, which is that he wore the Nazi coat. He was trying to look like a Nazi on camera by wearing this like long coat with like big brass buttons and an upturned collar because he was deliberately trying to evoke the Third Reich, which is something some of these Trump characters do sometimes, you know, like Stephen Miller does it sometimes.
Yeah.
But Greg Bovino was really embracing the aesthetic of the Nazi and trying to invite those comparisons, which I guess he found flattering.
And then in news that New York Times described as breaking, which it turns out he was anti-Semitic this entire time. Wow. Did not see that coming.
Yeah, he had a call with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota trying to get them to be more aggressive in pressing charges against protesters there. And the U.S. Attorney couldn't take the call on like a Friday night or a Saturday because it was Shabbat and he was offline and not working for religious observance. And Greg Bovino took the opportunity to say some fun anti-Semitic things, complaining that this guy wasn't available to, you know, like lock up liberals for him.
But Moira, I'm sorry, but I'm told that the greatest threat of anti-Semitism in the United States is my students camping on a lawn. So it can't be that.
Well, the U.S. attorney in Minnesota evidently thought so, which is reportedly why he decided to join the Trump administration's DOJ.
Oh, wow. A lot of fucking around and finding out right around now. Yeah.
Yeah. Play stupid games, win stupid prizes, folks. But, you know, the Trump administration did like, they offered up this head, right?
Yeah.
They're like, all right, this is the guy we're going to make take the fall. They put Greg Homan in charge.
Who is, fun fact, the same guy, basically.
Yeah, just like the same guy in a different font.
Yeah.
But he's a little less flashy, a little less in love with the camera than Greg Bovino was.
No duster.
There was a rumor that Kristi Noem was going to get fired. That seems to have ended. They had like one tense meeting where, you know, Kristi Noem struggled to make a facial expression that might indicate remorse or appeasement. And found that, you know, she could just kind of like blink and pout. And now, apparently, nothing has really changed on the ground in Minnesota. Dems momentarily looked like they were about to find a spine with this and then disabused everybody on that notion.
Yeah, Chuck Schumer talked to the Baileys, his imaginary friends, and they were like, "Now we're cool, Chuck." Yeah, my favorite thing is the Democrats did extract a promise from the administration that ICE would cease deporting American citizens. I'm like, I mean, world's slowest slow clap. Like, wow. They're going to abide by the Constitution? They promise. Like, retire, bitches. I'm sorry.
Also, in fact, already illegal.
Exactly. It's like, oh, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, there's a kind of shocking gap between public sentiment, which is growing more and more militantly anti-ICE, and the behavior of Democrats. There's also like a really shocking gap between the courage and determination and like effortfulness of the actual people of Minneapolis and the Democrats in Congress, including those representing them, like the likes of Amy Klobuchar, who just cannot be bothered to mount much of an opposition to this.
Well, there's an interesting kind of rupture there too, in that the state level politicians seem to manage. And Ilhan Omar is managing, the mayor of Minneapolis is managing, Tim Walz is managing. It's those people who have to go to Washington that somehow seem like, do they not go home? Is that what's happening? Like, it's very, very noticeable that like Democrats in Minnesota, so long as they don't live in D.C., seem to have located their spine just fine, right? And it's members of Congress largely that are just like unable to name this, unable to, I mean, it's the biggest fucking layup in the world. Like, you can make these people run scared for the next 6 months because, like, guess what? It's going to happen again and again and again, right? Like, you're not giving away anything by coming out against ICE because I'm sorry to say, but, like, ICE will murder again. It'll probably be next week, right? Like, it's just, it's astonishing to me that they aren't able to think further ahead than the next 2 days.
ICE is going to keep killing. They're going to keep killing people in their concentration camps. They're going to keep killing the people who oppose them. And I think the administration's sense is that it can use force, right? Like that force will intimidate the opposition. That does seem to work with elected Democrats, as you're saying, Adrian.
Yeah.
But it's not working with ordinary people. Ordinary
right.
people are seeing what happens to the likes of Renee Good, to the likes of Alex Priddy, to the likes of Liam Ramos. And it's not making them scared. that the same thing will happen to them. It's making them more willing, in fact, to risk those outcomes for the sake of justice. I think something to take away from what's happening in Minneapolis is not just like the cowardice and ineptitude and uselessness of, you know, Democratic congressional leadership, but it's also about the massive kindness and courage and capacity for like principled action that exists among ordinary people. I've actually been floored by it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's a cause for a lot of optimism that, you know, this is a demonstration of the fact that ordinary people are a lot stronger than we give them credit for.
I think that's right. At the same time, it does also give me sort of a higher order worry, which is to say that let's say this all blows over at some point. The spectacle of these 4 years will have been that average Americans have a greater deal of courage and moral certitude than any of their institutions. And yet we will need institutions to get through this. We need institutions to guide us forward and to, you know, rebuild a society in the wake of all this. How are we going to do that if everyone who looks at, you know, an elected official on the Democratic side, at a university president, at a corporate leader, and says, like, I did a lot more than you did, Bucko. I was courageous in ways that you couldn't imagine. You were ready to, you know, give the world's sloppiest hand job to these people, and I was the one who had to stand up and face armed thugs. That is deeply corrosive, I think, that people cannot look at their elected officials, at their elites, without utter disdain and utter disappointment. And so on the one hand, I am really, really in awe of what the people of Minnesota are doing, but I am also deeply worried about the inability of our institutions to keep pace with their heroism.
Yeah, you know, the courts are not going to save you, but maybe put some more trust in the mom group phone tree.
All right.
Thank you so much for listening to In Bed with the Right.
We also do have a Patreon episode coming out about the situation in Minneapolis and certain historical echoes. It's called American Gestapo, and it's going to be out probably the moment that this thing hits our regular feed. So check that out. That's at patreon.com/embedwiththeright. Be great for you to support us there, but we're hiding it behind the paywall because I don't want half of Germany yelling at me. So like, yeah, that's where it's going to go.
And we'll see you next time.
In Bed With The Right is made possible by hundreds of listeners who support us via patreon.com. Our episodes are produced and edited by Mark Yoshizumi and Katie Lau. Our title music is by Katie Lau.